It really is good to be here, and I have to say that I really love doing that retreat this spring with you all, too. I was really honored that John asked, and I love doing that. I see a number of you here that I recognize from that day back in, I think that was in March, wasn't it? A lot of water has gone under the bridge since then. All right. It was September 10th, 2001. You can probably figure out why I remember this date, and always will. My family and I were on vacation in Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia at that time. And that particular day on the 10th, it was cloudy and you know, threatened rain and things. So we didn't go to the beach that day. We just stayed where we were staying. And I went out to the pool with a book to read, a book that I'd brought along intentionally, along with a few others, but one that honestly I had avoided reading up to that point because I knew the title. It was very well known, and I already knew what it said just from that. It was Rich Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Church. So I kind of, you know, I didn't really want to read it. I kind of felt like I already knew. But that, I decided to take it on that vacation, and that day I took it to the pool with me, and I began to read that book. And I made it through enough of the first chapter that I came to this moment when Rick Warren talks about it being the job of church leaders not to sort of create their own wave or make their own thing or something like that, but rather to identify the next movement of God and His Spirit in the world, and to, like a surfer, position themselves, whether an individual or a church body like this one, or even a larger group of them, or something like that, but to position oneself to, like a surfer, catch and ride the wave of God's movement in the world. It was cloudy that day, overcast, there wasn't any sun, but I put on my sunglasses at that moment, because I began to weep. It was unexpected to me. By the way, I never made it any further in that book. I didn't read another word beyond that little explanation when it came. And I made God a promise that day, sitting by the pool at the place we were staying in Williamsburg. And the promise was, God, if you will help me to identify your next move in this world, I will do everything. I will do anything to be there and to be part of it, to be part of what you're doing. I'll do anything. Well, it's a big promise to make, right? And a few years later, God began to show me in some ways to help me to understand His movement in the world, and to give me a vision for how I was being called to be a part of that. And I wrote that vision down. I got it critiqued and from people, actually some people from all over the world, a lot of people. And it became evident over time that that was what God was really calling me to do. So in June of 2006, I did the dumbest thing I've ever done. I resigned the church I was pastoring in Southern Ohio with all its security and the things that go with that and stability and all. And I moved with my wife and three teenagers to Toledo, a city I was not from. I'd only visited three times in my life at that point. Without a job or a place to live, to try to do ministry I didn't yet know how to do because it was just so new and different, with people I didn't yet know how to meet. Dumbest thing I've ever done. Needless to say, my phone has not rung with a call from Harvard Business School asking me to come and teach about strategic planning. I also would not trade it for the world. What my family and I have done and been through here, as hard as it's been, I wouldn't trade it for anything. That has everything to do with this passage that was just read from 2 Samuel 6. I love the story. But in order to really understand what's happening here in 2 Samuel 6, you have to back up a whole book to 1 Samuel. The chapters are 4, 5, and 6, which give you the backstory that led up to this moment. Here's what happened. The Philistines and the Israelites had a series of battles, and the Israelites were getting spanked every single time. They just kept getting beat. And so somebody had this brilliant idea. Well, if we would have the Ark of God with us, if we would have the Ark of Covenant, God's presence, that's the way they viewed that Ark. If God's presence were with us, there's no way we could lose. So they brought the Ark of God with the army to a place called Ebenezer. We just mentioned it a few minutes ago in a song. And that's a whole other sermon, what that place is really about. But there was a battle again between the Israelites and the Philistines at the site of Ebenezer. And again, despite the Ark's presence on the field, the Philistines routed the Israeli army and they captured the Ark of God. They sent a runner, a Bethlehemite, to go back to Shiloh, which was the religious capital of Israel during the time of the judges. So this guy ran to the city and he announces in the hearing of the city to report that the army has been devastated by the Philistines and that the Philistines have now captured the Ark of God. And there is this cry of mourning, grief, suffering that rises in the city from all the people who have heard this so loud that the priest, the old priest now Eli, hears the sound of this mourning, this groaning, this grieving, and he sends somebody to ask what's going on. By this time, Eli is about 98 years old, and he's not able to get around. He's pretty overweight, and he's just in his chair. And somebody goes out and finds out the information. They bring back to Eli the news that not only has the army been defeated, but his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, have also been killed in that battle, and the Ark of the Lord has been captured by the Philistines. And Eli, in his great suffering over this, his great mourning over this, falls over backwards in his chair, breaks his neck, and dies. Meanwhile, in another part of town, Eli's daughter-in-law gets the news that not only has the army been routed, but now her father-in-law, Eli, has died with the news that his two sons, including her own husband, have been killed in the battle, and the Ark of God has been captured by the Philistines. And this comes as such a shock to her that this woman who is pregnant goes into labor, during which she dies, but not before she gives birth to a son whom she names Ichabod, which means the glory has departed, or no glory. The glory is gone, and she names her son this, and then she dies. Well, meanwhile, back at the battlefield, the Philistines load up their treasure of this Ark of God. I mean, after all, the thing's made of gold, right? And so they load it up, and they're heading back down in their great triumphal procession down to one of the coastal cities called Ashdod, one of the five great cities of the Philistines. They go down to Ashdod, bringing this treasure with them. And somebody gets this brilliant idea that, wow, this is a pretty nice-looking piece of furniture. It would really dress up Dagon's temple, their god Dagon. So they take them to Dagon's temple, take the Ark to Dagon's temple, and they set it right beside the statue of Dagon at the front of the temple. And they step back and they say, wow, I should get a job as an interior designer. And then they just go on about their business the rest of the day. The next morning, they come back to Dagon's temple, and they go in to find out Dagon's statue has been toppled over to the floor. They're going, oh, well, we must have jostled him when we were putting this box into place, so let's just set him back up again, because after all, and so they set Dagon up, and they step back and admire their handiwork one more time, and then they go on about their day. When they go back the next morning, Dagon has been toppled over again. This time, his head and his arms are broken off. And now they're getting a little scared because this was a big smackdown by the Ark of the Covenant over Dagon. Well, while all this is going on, very uncomfortable with the Ark of God in town. All the people are being hit with this plague of hemorrhoids, and the whole town becomes infested with rats, and they're going, get this thing out of here. So they think, okay, here's what we're going to do. We don't really like those Ekronites very well, so we're going to send this piece of furniture that's just made it so uncomfortable here, we're going to send it to Ekron, and they can deal with all the trouble. Unfortunately, so they send it to Ekron. Unfortunately, the reputation of the ark has preceded it. So they don't want it already. So they go to their priests and diviners who say, well, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to get rid of this thing, but just in case this is all coincidence and it really didn't have to do with the ark and it's really not their God and that God's not really all that powerful, we're going to do it this way. First of all, we're going to send it away with a guilt offering of 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats. Well, you know how you would make something like that out of gold. You have to make a mold. So who wants the job of making the mold of the hemorrhoids to send as the guilt offering with the Ark of God? Any takers? Oh, well, you know the economy is down when somebody wants that job, right? So they had to make molds of the tumors and the rats, and they sent those 5 of each with the Ark of God, for which they built a new cart. They had done a little research, apparently, and they knew about this. They built a new cart on which to set the Ark, and they put it on 2 cattle, both of whom had given birth but had never pulled a cart. They'd never been previously yoked, so they were virgins in that respect, and they realized that this was important. And then they sent it away, and they said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to turn these cattle loose with the Ark and the guilt offering on it, including the hemorrhoids, and we're not going to turn on the GPS. We're not going to do anything like that. We're just going to set them free. And if they go to Beth Shemesh, which was the nearest Israeli-held city at that time, if they go there, then we're going to know it was their God, and we're just going to leave the thing alone. But on the off chance that it really wasn't their God, and these cattle just go wandering off with this box on their backs, then we can sneak the thing back into town, and we'll know that all this bad stuff has nothing to do with the ark, and so we'll be able to keep it. At least we can scrap it out. So they get all of this ready, and they turn the cattle loose, and those cattle make a beeline for Beth Shemesh to the house of a guy named Joshua. And at Joshua's house, and so they realize, you know, all these priests and diviners of the Philistines, they've followed it along, and they see where it goes, and they just kind of go slinking off, hoping not to be noticed. Meanwhile, the Levites come, and they set the Ark of God down onto a rock so it's secure, and they can worship, and they can sacrifice there and all of that. And then curiosity kills 70 Beth Shemesh cats who just couldn't resist looking into the box. Gone. Tough day, Beth Shemesh. So nobody wanted it there either. So they sent it on ahead to Abinadab's house at Kiriath Jearim, which is about 12 or so miles west of Jerusalem still. And at Abinadab's house, Abinadab's son, Eliezer, is appointed to guard the ark. And there, the ark of the covenant, that box where the manifest presence of God for his people dwelt, stayed at Abinadab's house under the watchful eye of his son for 20 years. And during those 20 years, the Israelites became quite accustomed to living in Ichabod. Thank you very much. It just became commonplace for them. They grew accustomed to living without the presence of God near, to living in a place where God was not for them. I mean, they just sort of gave it up, and they were doing okay. They were patting each other on the back, I'm sure, and saying, there, we're doing okay, we're making it, aren't we? And eventually, it wasn't even that, because it was just the norm to live in Ichabod for Israel now. It was normal for them to live in Ichabod, something that God had never intended for them or any other of his people. God intended that they would live in his presence. But but they became accustomed to living without it. How sad is that? Well, this message today is not about what David did wrong in this story that meant that they didn't take the ark back to Jerusalem, or even Uzzah, or anybody else. This is really about Obed-Edom. So, have you ever considered what this must have been like? I'm sure you've heard this story before. I bet most, if not all of you, have heard this story before, maybe even heard it preached. But do you ever ask yourself, like, what was that like when they did that? Like, right now in my family, we have this really ugly white elephant gift that's making the rounds. Every time somebody has an event or an occasion, it's showing up on their doorstep. And so a few weeks ago, my sister and my brother-in-law had their 31st wedding anniversary, and so we took this tree, and my wife parked down the street a little bit, and I went walking up from the side where I knew they couldn't see me even if they were in the living room. I put it on their porch, and I rang the doorbell and ran. You think they did that with the ark? I doubt that. So just imagine with me for a minute what you think that was like. So it's late in the afternoon in Kiriath-Jearim, and you're at the farm of a man named Obed-Edom and his family. Mrs. Obed-Edom has been inside getting dinner ready. Little Bobby and Susie Obed-Edom have made their way home from school. Mr. Obed-Edom comes in at the end of a long day of work, dry and dusty. And he comes inside, he's cleaning up for dinner, and there comes a knock at the door. Mr. Obed-Edom, of course the protector of his family, goes to the door. He's going to answer the door because they're not used to getting visitors really out here. And he goes up and he opens the door. Mr. Obed-Edom? Yes? Mr. Obed-Edom, do you see the man standing out there in the road? Yes, I see him. Well, sir, that man is King David. And King David has a question for you, or a request of you. King David wants to know, of course, Obed-Edom says, well, okay, if it's the king, I'm all ears. Well, sir, King David would like to know, would you be willing to keep God for a while? Well, Mr. Obed-Edom says, hold on a minute. Let me check with my wife. Honey, King David wants to know if we can keep God for a while. Okay, yeah, she says it's okay. Just come right this way. And they come in bearing the Ark of God, and they bring it through the front door and into the living room where Obed-Edom is busy opening up some space right next to the TV. And they set the Ark of the Covenant down on the floor next to the TV, and these men, the Levites that brought it in, they go out the door and down the street with King David. The door shuts behind them, and the house is very, very quiet. And all the family, even though dinner is getting close, all the family gathers in the living room, and they all sit on the couch together, staring at the box on the floor next to the TV. The TV wasn't on. I'll tell you one thing, it would take the presence of God in my house for the TV not to be on. And so that's the way it was for them. And they sat there just enthralled, looking at the Ark of God sitting in their very own living room. And eventually, they sort of shook themselves awake. And Mrs. Obed-Edom says, well, dinner's ready. Let's go eat dinner. And they go out there. And it was an amazing dinner that night. Little Bobby and Susie ate their black-eyed peas without a question. Mrs. Obed-Edom practically dropped her cup of tea when Mr. Obed-Edom offered to do the dishes. And after all that was over, they all went back in as a family and they sat down on the couch, staring at the box on the floor next to the TV. Well, that night when it became bedtime, little Bobby and Susie had school the next morning after all, and Mr. Obed-Edom, well, he's got to work early in the morning on the farm, and so eventually they had to go to bed. Bobby and Susie, they They brushed their teeth and said their prayers without incident. They weren't even picking at each other, either over dinner or even throughout the evening. They just were kind to one another. Things were just really different now. And that night, for the first time in several months, since a fox had broken into their sheep pen and killed one of their sheep, Bobby had been having nightmares every single night about this kind of violence. And that night, for the first time in months, little Bobby Obed-Edom slept the night through in peace. The next day, they went to school, and everything was just wonderful. And the next day, Mr. Obed-Edom offered to wash the dishes again, and they ate their black-eyed peas again for a second day in a row without question. I'm having trouble with this. I apologize. It's kind of sliding around. The scripture says in this that for 90 days while the ark was in Obed-Edom's house, I really apologize, while the ark was in Obed-Edom's house, the whole household was blessed. Well, what does that mean? I mean, everything about their household was blessed. There were farmers. I mean, they were probably having carrots the size of your arm. And cabbage heads the size of a basketball. The kids were getting straight A's in schools, and they were getting citizenship awards, and they were helping out around the house and making their bed in the morning and all that kind of stuff. The cattle, the donkeys, the sheep, even the cattle's are pregnant. The cattle's are pregnant. The cattle are pregnant. The donkeys are pregnant. The sheep are pregnant. Even Mrs. Obed-Edom was pregnant. The whole household was blessed. Actually, according to rabbinical writings, both Mrs. Obed-Edom and all six of their daughters-in-law were pregnant during this time. All six. It was an amazing time. The family's getting along, and Mrs. Obed-Edom finds herself over and over sitting with her cup of tea and just smiling softly as she reflects on how attentive Mr. Obed-Edom has been. And together they sit and they just look at the box on the floor next to the TV over and over and over again. And life is just good. Filled with goodness. Well, 90 days later, there came another knock on the door. Mr. Obed-Edom, having come in from the fields again that day, goes and he answers the door. It's the same Secret Service dude at the door. Mr. Obed-Edom? Yes? Mr. Obed-Edom, is God still here? He says, yes, he's still right over here by the TV. And they push past him, saying, King David wants the ark back, and step aside. And they push past him, and the Levites come in, and they slide the pole through poles through the ring, and they pick it up on their shoulders, and they go whisking out the door, down the sidewalk and the little picket fence, and they pick up King David on the road, and they head down towards Jerusalem singing, we bring the sacrifice of praise. And the whole family watches out the door for a few minutes until they've disappeared in the distance. And a sadness settles over the house as they all file back into the living room, and they sit on the couch together and they stare at the space on the floor next to the TV where God had been for 90 days. That night at dinner, Bobby and Susie still weren't picking at each other, and they were still eating their black-eyed peas, and Mr. Obed-Edom still did the dishes. And they still sat in the living room again later that night, staring at that space, but there was a deep sadness settling over the family. That night, Bobby had his nightmare again for the first time in 90 days. It's interesting to note that Obed-Edom is mentioned elsewhere in the scriptures. In 1 Chronicles 15 and 16, is one of those places where Obed-Edom is named among those who are chosen to be gatekeepers of the ark at the temple in Jerusalem. Now, we don't know exactly who Obed-Edom was, but he was a Gittite, so he was from Gath. So that at one point was part of Philistine territory. He could have been a Philistine who had just come to recognize that God really was God. He may have also been a Levite, a lower order Levite. It says in chapter 15 of 1 Chronicles, verse 18, that he played the harp. He may very well have been a Levite. But whatever he was, what he became was a gatekeeper for the presence of God. You know what this means? They lived on a farm about 12 miles outside the city. This is commuter distance now. It was not commuter distance then. Obed-Edom apparently, and his family, apparently at some point, and I don't think it was very long, realized they were not willing to live in Ichabod anymore. They had tasted and seen what it was like to live where God was living, where God was moving. They had seen what it was like, and they were no longer willing to live in Ichabod. They were not willing to live where the presence of God was not. They were not willing to live where the glory had departed, where it was all gone. They were not willing to do it anymore. And so at some point, Obed-Edom must have gotten rid of his farm. Maybe it was even his family farm, maybe from generations. And he moved his family from their nice, quiet country life into the city, the stinky, smelly city where the temple was, just so he could sit outside the door of the place where God was. By the way, this was not a high and lofty position, this gatekeeper thing. It was like being a porter at a hotel. Obed-Edom was so desperate to stop living, to not go back to living in Ichabod, to stay where the presence was, where the glory was. He was so desperate to do that, he gave up his family business and moved into the city so he could sit there and hold people's bags while they went in. Because he just wasn't willing to live in Ichabod anymore. Friends, can I just tell you that that implies a question. It begs a question of us. It begs the question whether we are willing to live without God's presence simply because we can get along, because we can keep going along, because we can keep the doors open, because we can still sort of keep our normal ways of doing things, our normal life. Or are we going to be people who say, no, I've tasted and I know that the presence of God is beautiful, powerful, transformative, blessing over the top, and I'm not willing to live where that is not. I think in the end, every human being needs to decide that. Every human being needs to have their moment by the pool like I did on September 10th, 2001. And by the way, that wasn't the only one of those moments I've had, but it was one. Over and over and over again, because of the way life works, this question is demanded of us. An answer to this question is demanded. Are you going to be willing to do whatever it takes to be where God is? Now, I'm not saying that everybody's got to sell all their stuff, which we also did, and move to some place they're not from and do the dumb thing I did. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that when God moves in your life, are you willing to put everything else aside in order to be where He is? Or is that just going to be too much to ask? And we're just going to become accustomed to living in Ichabod. That is a weighty question, isn't it? I know it's heavy. It's really heavy. I also know that this church in Point Place has movement in it. That God is at work. God is moving. There's something in the wind. And the reason that I wanted to share this particular thing with you today is to encourage you so that you will have courage as God speaks to you about where His next movement is. That you would be determined that you're not going to learn to live in Ichabod. That you're going to move where God moves. So much of the time in the church we have been... Remember the pillars of cloud and fire that God used to lead the people in the wilderness? For a time, do you remember that? Do you know how often in the church God has moved? The pillars of cloud and fire have moved on and we're still sleeping in our cots in the camp. And we wake up all sleepy and groggy and peek our head out of the tent and see, oh, there's no pillar of cloud or fire here anymore. Oh, well, I'll just go back to bed and maybe tomorrow it will be back. No. God moves. God is, in fact, moving. The question isn't that. The question is whether you and I are going to be people willing to live in Ichabod, or if we will be willing to do whatever it takes to be gatekeepers at the door, at the doorway of God's presence, at the doorway of God's glory, to see to it that not only we ourselves, but others who may come in contact with us will also learn what it's like to live as if the very presence of God is occupying that space on the floor of the living room of our hearts, next to the TV that grabs so much of our attention. Are we going to be people willing to do whatever it takes to go there, to be where God is? I'm a visitor, a guest here. I probably have no business saying anything this heavy to you, this weighty to you. And yet here I am doing it. I don't know. I have a gift for doing dumb things. But I hope you can hear me today. This is not a condemning word. This is a challenge, an invitation to the greatest thing there is as the people of God, to follow God's movement. Wherever it goes. Wherever it goes. Say, I will do whatever it takes. Lord, I thank you for the beauty and the power and the reality of your presence, your glory. And God, I acknowledge that I have, and your body has, far too often allowed ourselves to become accustomed to living in Ichabod. Apart from your glory and presence, after all, we're making it okay. We're doing okay. God, teach us what it's like to be willing, like a surfer, to not only get our direction like, but to get right, but to get up to speed. So that when your wave comes, we are ready to move with it, to ride it, and to be a part of what you are so graciously doing to redeem your world. Help us with this, O God, I pray. Amen.